Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Yeah, right here in Austin, Texas. You're in Hollywood.
Yeah, I'm in Burbank, California, where it's raining and people are panicking. And you know who else was panicking? Justin Robert Young.
Oh man, I think I'm too exhausted to panic. It's been a pretty jam packed 3 days here in the heartland of America, Des Moines, Iowa.
Yeah,
Justin, for those you don't know, is out there promoting, pimping out the Contender board game.
I know, and the good news is that as much of a shameless shill as I've been, I don't even crack the top 10 of people shamelessly shilling here during the run-up to the Iowa caucus. There's at least 12 other people who are more shamelessly trying to get their message out, which is good news for me.
Yeah. How does that go over when you walk into campaign headquarters and you're like, hi, we wanted to talk to you about a card game. And they're like, we're trying to elect the leader of the free world here.
We're going to put out a thing on Medium probably tonight where we rank our gift horse index of campaigns that were either friendly or not friendly to us. But it really ran the gamut. You know, we had some people like Bernie Sanders' campaign and Ben Carson's campaign was actually the nicest. It was just like they were so nice. Like the volunteers were super nice. The volunteers wanted to take pictures with us, which was a change of pace. And then others, including Rick Santorum's, which did not allow us inside the campaign offices. But then again, I think two youthful-looking folks with funny hats and a camera probably rarely turns out well for them. so I don't really take it personally or blame them. And then the Hillary Clinton campaign, very much guarded, very on guard, and very cautiously took the game and then told us that if we were going to take a picture inside their lobby, we had to call their press secretary to ask for permission.
Wow.
It ran the gamut. But then again, you know, a lot of times it depends on who you're talking to and there's a lot of risk aversion, you know, like no one, even if people personally think it's a rad thing, you know, whether or not they think that it's going to be, a potential embarrassment that, like, in a close race could ruin something. Like, I can understand some of the hesitation. But at the same time, I'm trying to give you a card game and then take a picture in your lobby. Calm down.
Well, I think we'll go into this a little bit more in After Things, perhaps, and talk about some of the promotional sort of approaches you're taking. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, here in Weird Things this week, sad to say the passing of a very, very interesting guy, Marvin Minsky, who was one of the pioneers of artificial intelligence, and he was a frequent speaker early on at the Amazing Meetings, and I had the pleasure of driving Marvin around a lot and talking to him and having some interesting conversations with him, and sad to see him go, very, very sad to see his passing.
Amazing. I had no idea that you got to know him on a personal level. I remember reading about his work when I was in college, 20 plus years ago, when I was doing right around the time, I want to say Rodney Brooks was working on the little robotic bugs and his approach, an evolutionary approach to artificial intelligence, like let's do an artificially intelligent cockroach before we do a human, was kind of at odds with Marvin Minsky. Sort of represented the longer term, you know, the more established takes on artificial intelligence at the time. It was fascinating.
I mean, there was a different. I mean, Marvin was kind of part of his approach was getting into the idea of consciousness and stuff, which is something that, you know, gets into a different thing. His book that he wrote was Papert, Society of the Mind, kind of got into sort of the modular approach and then how these things sort of working together created this sort of thread. So far more complicated than I'm really capable of really understanding or defending or articulating. But Marvin was one of the early pioneers and probably one of the first transhumanists in many senses and talking about, you know, how we would live and upload and whatnot, our consciousness and the ideas behind that. he had a couple things that made me think about stuff. One was he loved magic, absolutely loved magic, and he thought that every school kid should take a class in magic. And not just to understand deception, but also to learn how adults could be readily deceived. And he was very much about challenging authority, challenging arguments from authority, and thought that it was absolutely critical that, you know, he was a very young mind. He was a guy that was always like overturning things and looking for, well, what aren't we looking at? What don't we see? And so he loved the idea that every kid should probably learn at some point to understand, like, no, people I trust, people who are credible, intelligent, can be fooled. And then another thing he said, which struck me, was our friends know us better than ourselves. And he was talking a lot about the idea of if you're trying to recreate our consciousness or our personalities, et cetera, the idea that you have, you know, there's our concept of ourself, but if our friends were to sit down and describe us, they might be able to create a better model of who we are than we could.
You know, both of those are fascinating, but to go to the first point, I think that is almost a more prescient lesson now than it really ever has been. The idea that everybody can be fooled and respected figures and, you know, authority figures and people that we trust and people that we love aren't always right. And that loving them or respecting them doesn't necessarily mean always believing that they are infallible and in our era now, which I think we can all agree is something that is for the better. And this is certainly not a Luddite argument, but I do think that one of the awkward growing pains of our multimedia world is that ideas get such momentum so fast. Now they're able to be counteracted fast, but I think that our next kind of communication evolution is just going to be kind of maybe taking those lessons more to heart. That, like, okay, well, what is this? What am I hearing? Where did I hear it from? And is it correct? And is there a way for me to think about that more critically?
Mm-hmm. I think that we, in this age of information, we fall back on sometimes bad habits. And I've seen this, I've been having a thing on Twitter where I brought up, I was reading up on Polywell fusion, which is just another approach to try to do fusion.
By the way, your two biggest things on Twitter are reading up on Polywell fusion and trying to eat 20 chicken nuggets at the same time.
And let me just say that I probably know more about eating chicken nuggets than Polywell fusion. And that was one of the things I commented there. I said, like, listen, I'm reading, I said, I better clarify this to say, not that I think I understand it or grasp or I'm an expert on this at all. It's a thing that's interesting to me, but I didn't want to present myself out there as, well, everybody, here I am. It was just, I spent Friday evening watching, there's a Google talk by Robert Bussard before he passed away, talking about his approach towards it. And he was one of the original developers of the Tokamak reactor, who then says, no, that's not going to be the way we get fusion. And then I have a friend who's invested in a fusion company and all that. And so it was just this sort of thing I went through. But I got into a back and forth. I had a couple of people like, well, what about this and what about that? And they're kind of just, they're Googling fusion and just throwing things to say to me, you know?
Well, yeah. That's the problem with Twitter as a platform. It's just like, hi, I'm somebody you'd like to have a conversation with and I'd like to talk about this subject. And then it's like, oh, crap. If I could just say words that mean something to him, he'll talk back.
Yeah, and I kind of had this sort of like, and it's like, I'm not an expert, but like, I'm like, no, what you're saying doesn't make any sense at all. Here's a video, go watch this thing, and then come back to me. Yeah, but first, and that was the thing that got frustrating to me, like being involved in the skeptics world was, you know, we'd have this, we would Google search, you know, people Google search whatever arguments and throw them at you. What, so-and-so said this. I mean, did you read it? Did you read the paper? Are you just regurgitating it? And this came to, those two things merged when I was looking up, you know, the Wikipedia entry on Bussard, and I found a JREF forum entry where he was talking about Robert Bussard, Bussard Ramjet, you know? He was one of the pioneers, head of like Los Alamos, whatever, amazing physicist, got incredible history, and developed, you know, an approach towards, you know, taking an old idea called the fusor, which is sort of electrical fusion, and had a company that, you know, was working on this, and they did government contracts and ran out of money. But anyhow, he wrote something saying, hey, yeah, we're looking if somebody can fund us or whatever. Somehow somebody on the JREF forum picked this up and thought he was some crank cold fusionist or something like this.
Oh, no.
And so you read this thread where people are like, yeah, this is dubious. I don't think this makes sense here or whatever. This has got all the warning signs. And I'm like, idiots. Like, and there's like one or two voices of reason who are trying to, like, you know what, like, it's this is an area of which we know nothing about. You know, and that's hard. And I'm guilty of that. My God, I know I am. Where I'm like, well, I know a thing or two about, you know, and then, you know, falling into
and then as soon as it goes over your head, you're like, no, I meant that literally. I know a thing, maybe two about this. Yeah.
I can count them up. But yeah, I mean, like, man, if there's one gift I want to pass on to the world is that my steadfast philosophy that, like, I want it to be cool to admit you're dumb every once in a while for smart people, right? Just say and not say not be willfully ignorant, not be resistant to learning, but just like say I'm stupid on this and I would like to learn more. It's just such a better vantage point than, you know, drumming your fingers together and saying, I don't know.
There is the and I am not a member of this camp, right? There are kind of two camps in skepticism. One that says that we should patiently examine everything and make believers of everyone. And then there's the camp that believes that you can accomplish more to stop nonsense with a derisive snort than you can with an hour of patient explanation to them. And so, you know, the counter argument is from those people, yeah, but how many hours are we going to waste, you know, listening to insane talk? And, you know, there are people out there who put literally insane things out there, and you are dumber for having read them.
The big one we'll talk at the end of the show about that. But here's the problem with the derisive snort. I was around a lot of snorting people who were flat out wrong on a number of things. And they were in their wheelhouse. And like the problem with experts and scientists is they are very knowledgeable in a certain specific domain. And I have seen this repeatedly where I'm at like conferences and areas where you have people from different areas. And I've even seen like biologists express, you know, who study, you know, let's say paleontology. You know, paleontologists express completely, totally ignorant thoughts about human evolution. Not like it's creationism, but not understanding like why do we understand that there is a differentiation between, you know, Neanderthals and things like that? Because they don't know. I mean, it's not in the journals they read. It's not what they do. They have no more knowledge than the average layperson does. But because they wear the hat of the scientist and all this, they put on that mantle. And that's one of the problems we have with some of the public figures who talk about science is they are extremely knowledgeable in one domain and they're very, very, very capable speakers. And then people think these people are the most brilliant people in the world because they watch them read a script about all this other stuff and assume they know it. But they don't. They don't, you know. And the ones I trust are the ones like Justin pointed out, like Richard Feynman, who are like, hey, I don't know. This is interesting. Well, yeah, here we can look at this thing here and we can find this out. But, you know.
Yeah, and Feynman, man, he really was the paragon of being somebody who was extremely knowledgeable, somebody who had one of those fantastic once in a generation or multiple generations intuitive grasp of physics. I want to say it was a Feynman story, like the story that my physics teacher, Pseudoscience and the Paranormal, told is that Feynman had such a grasp of the nature of science that when news broke that in Soviet Russia somebody claimed to have created a polymer base of water or a water polymer, he just sort of paused and said, no, that's not possible, because if that was true, you would have a living creature would have developed itself made purely of water and polymers. And then I'm sure I'm mangling the entire thing, but just to hear hear what's allegedly news and and then to immediately grasp the implications of that news and to know why it couldn't be possible. And of course, it turns out that the guy just hadn't cleaned his test tubes correctly. But at any rate, if you read his book, and this will be my pick, I'll tell you in advance, like Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, or What Do You Care What Other People Think? Such a great way to keep an open mind and to find yourself doing hippie bongo drums, drumming stuff, or to, you know, painting the side of your car with the, you know, giant quantum mechanics graphs. And, you know, he was really into the idea of altered states of consciousness. He used to do isolation tanks and try to move his sense of self from behind his eyes down to his liver, as some cultures believed. Yeah. But you know, I guess, but the problem is, of course, we can't all be Feynmans.
No. Yeah, we don't have those kind of brain cells to spare.
or even have them to begin with.
in the spirit of exploration, this is kind of exciting. Over 1,000 college and high school students converged in Texas this weekend to do what? To do what?
To go to Penny Arcade Expo happening right now. Yeah, down
I was
going to
say,
Antonio.
Yeah, aside from PAX South.
No. That wasn't it.
No, I don't know. Is this one that are we going to be surprised by the answer? Should we try to suss it out?
So what it was is that at Texas A&M University, they had a Hyperloop competition.
Oh, I read about the results of this. I had no idea that happened here in Texas.
So what it was is there was a competition to try to develop a pod to fit in the Hyperloop. For Hyperloop, for those of you who don't remember, was just 3 years ago, Elon Musk teased us with like, hey, I've got a radical new idea for transportation. Don't have the time to develop it, but I'll release a white paper on it for my, you know, SpaceX engineers and let you all play with it. And so what it was is basically a vacuum tube cylinder with a pod that floats through on a little curtain of air that could go up to like 720 miles an hour. And it would take much, much less infrastructure for that than, let's say, conventional high-speed rails or the other ways we've done it. Threw it out there, and, you know, there was the, okay, great, that's wonderful. So now what? Well, a lot of people loved this idea, and a lot of engineering students, a lot of other people got very excited about this. And then 3 years later, we actually have, there's three firms that are, like, funded a multi-millions of dollars to develop their own Hyperloop transport systems. SpaceX has said, you know what? We'll take some of our property here, buy our factory, and we will build a test track, like a 1/3 scale or 1/4 scale test track. So if somebody wants to build a pod and test it in there, we'll let them do that. And now there was just this design competition for people to present their designs for this, different universities, different groups to do that. And the winners would be getting funding to take it up, to build up to a scale test model. The best overall design winner, MIT. The Innovation Award went to Delft Hyperloop from the University of Technology in Delft in the Netherlands. Technical Excellence Award, Badger Loop, and of University of Wisconsin-Madison, Virginia Tech, and University of California. So there was even a Reddit team that got together to compete and to put some stuff together. So kind of amazing, because what it is Elon Musk put together this very cool, radical idea, and a lot of people decided this is something worth, you know, developing. And we may, I think we'll see something, maybe not here in the United States readily, but I think somewhere in the world or someplace like maybe Nevada or something, which is still technically the United States, I understand that, we might get some form of it. But I think it bodes well when we get fully reusable rockets and we can start doing things like space station design and deep space exploration, all that. There are thousands of people out there waiting to design exciting projects.
Yeah, man. And the funny part is, as bearish as I am on the implementation of a Hyperloop for non-technical reason, I am super bullish on the technology. I think in so many ways, the technology is going to happen very, very quickly and work very, very well, because all of the problems with it are either technical problems, which I think are eminently fixable, or they are legal problems, which is, I think, less fixable, you know, issues of eminent domain and current layouts. And as you talked about, you know, out in, you know, Saudi Arabia or whatever, this probably makes a hell of a lot of sense where there's plenty of room to put it.
And apparently one of the visitors there was the U.S. Transportation Secretary, and he, Anthony Fox, and says that he, very solid idea, and was a, you know, so the government had a responsibility to back innovation, maybe even helping fund it. So, you know, there's obviously they're like, what, wait, this could be a big, huge public works project in a lot of different states, you know, all right, yeah. Now we're on board. Okay.
Which by the way, is the best part about something like this is, you know, in the spirit of politics, since I'm out here in Iowa, the idea of the Hyperloop catching momentum in an era where we keep putting these what I believe to be, you know, kind of silly high-speed rail public works initiatives out there. I mean, just the specter of like, well, let's not fund these not actually high-speed rails is huge.
Well, that's just it. Is that the problem is that, you know, when I talk to people here in California, like, well, you know, if only we'd get this high speed rail thing done, I'm like, it's not high speed rail. It's a lie. It's not. It's we're being fed this myth for, because there's so many people who are going to make a lot of money, you know, off of government.
It's exactly as high speed as the Wi-Fi at your local hotel. That's
yeah,
it. When they
exactly.
offer high speed internet, that's what they got.
If it was a real high speed, yes, but it's not. And that's is your but if we do this, we'll do. You get into this. If we bet on this bad idea, it'll become a great idea. And like that never works out well. It never works out well. And but it shows you we want these things. It's just that we often don't have an understanding of how we get
so
from here to there.
Tell me this. I'm curious as to why the thrust of Hyperloop is for people moving, because I think that's a really, I mean, unless there's something about the technology itself that makes it unable to handle heavy weight loads.
No,
it seems
Brian,
to
there's
me like
two
cargo. It
must,
should be.
Musk suggested two versions. One was a person version, and one was like $1 billion or $2 billion more that would be cargo too.
Now, the cargo thing, I think, absolutely. Think about moving perishables super fast, that, you know, way, way faster than trains and so on, and way more efficient. I feel like that's where the money is. I don't know how much better.
Your cost per we have a remarkably efficient or cheap system for moving a lot of those sort of items, and your cost per pound, you're going to make far you're able to charge a much higher premium per person than you would per pound of like produce.
Well, I guess I how much faster would this be than a flight, you know, TSA lines notwithstanding?
Well, what are you trying to? I mean, at certain cargo, yes, but when you're talking about perishables and stuff like that, I don't know. I mean, it depends too. Like short answer is yes, there's a cargo option, which would mean would have to have a wider, you know, tube and et cetera and all that. But yes, that can be done, and I could see FedEx wanting to, you know, use this for certain capabilities. Absolutely,
dude. Imagine. You know, you just send a Hyperloop from, you know, Amazon Central that goes to a city. The thing just pops open and, 10,000 drones just fly out with packages like a swarm and they're back in 5 seconds.
Not terrifying at all.
it's the future, man. It's coming for us.
All right. Speaking of the future, do we have a future here, guys?
Yeah.
Is there a future for the show?
There is. If you go to patreon.com/weirdthings, that's the way you can support the show, man. You can keep us going, make this a regular full-time gig for all of us. And we thank the 434 patrons who are pledging just a few bucks here or there to keep us regular. You are our Metamucil.
You make it happen. You are the hyper in our loop. We appreciate that. Gentlemen, meanwhile, at that Hyperloop at the conference, they had a special guest show up.
What? Was it Elon Musk? It was Elon Musk, wasn't it?
It was Elon Musk.
Yeah!
Elon Musk was there to, you know, congratulate them what they're doing and tell them that he was encouraged by what they're going to do and wanted to, you know, follow through on the development there. And you understand, for thousands of budding engineers, it's literally Tony Stark showing up at the Tony Stark Expo.
Yeah.
Pretty much exactly what that is. And I think we need to have the Elon Musk Expo now, where we'll be like SpaceX, Tesla, Hyperloop, you know, Solar City, whatever, all this sort of crazy stuff. But Musk made an appearance earlier in the week, I believe, at a Hong Kong tech conference, and he dropped a couple big bombs.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I read these quotes from Elon Musk, and obviously we revere the man on this podcast, but you just get the sense that maybe a man who is a passionate fan of Burning Man just kind of shows up to some of these conferences and between, you know, the night before and everything. It's just like that dude is prone to just let it fly here and again.
Well, he did let it fly. A couple of things that he mentioned. I guess he mentioned this at the Hyperloop was that he thinks Falcon Heavy is going to fly later this summer, which will be the largest rocket since the Saturn V. And when he was at the Hong Kong conference, he said they asked him about Mars and like, you know, when do you think you might be going to Mars, or when do you think you might be going into space? And he mentioned some sort of 5-year time frame. And then he said, as far as a Mars mission, an actual Mars mission, he said 2025 is a target. 2025.
That seems insane to me because yes.
All right, Brian, let's go knock on his door and tell him to
no,
stop.
No. Here's why, and I'm sure you can help me break this down, because number one, it's fantastic that we are tackling you know, the greatest barrier to our ascent to space, which is getting out of the gravity well cheaply. And it looks like we're on track to have that happen. And yes, within 5 years, all of a sudden we just start sending, you know, flights up weekly, daily, just nonstops.
Well,
to
10 years, but to, yeah, 9 years. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, but see, this is my point, though. If he's saying we can launch and go to Mars in 10 years, it's not like we're going to crack the cheap to space problem and then suddenly also crack the build a Starship Enterprise that can make a, you know, a 3 year journey out to Mars and back. I mean, that seems like a longer timeline than 10 years.
One, I don't know. Let me make it clear. Every Weird Things podcast needs to start with, hey, we don't know.
We don't know.
We don't know. But we're going to talk about it anyways. He has an entire company and group of people, some of the most brilliant people in the world, trying to solve these problems from spacesuit designs and other things. And there are a lot of technologies we're going to need. I agree. I'm just saying what he said, and this is a guy. He is a rocket scientist. This is the guy building reusable rockets. He is a credible guy, and he's still sticking to that time frame, which, you know, so if it slips by 5 years or even 10 years, we're still way into the game. So, you know, his plan is he wants to unveil. There's a conference in September, which is this big aeronautics conference, where he says he's going to unveil the MCT technology, he might talk about it before, but give the details of it, which is the Mars Colonial Transport, which will be a much larger rocket than the Falcon Heavy, this humongous rocket with fully reusable that's designed to go from here to Mars and back and create a circuit. He wants to create not just a mission, he wants to build effing railroads to Mars. Yeah. That is what he's talking about doing, is building railroads that go back and forth over and over again. Not literal railroads, just don't. But, you know, the idea of having a viable, consistent system of back and forth. So, shucks. 1,000 people showed up for Hyperloop, you know, for a silly little train.
I mean, also, maybe my favorite quote from that story was that Elon Musk said, you know, that he's very much excited to go to space. He's done a few training exercises. But other than that, you know, how much is there to it? How much practice do you need to float around?
Yeah, that was because the interviewer's asking, like, oh, are you doing training before your first space mission and all that? You float, you know, just the Elon Musk.
I'm learning to play. It's going to get hard to play Hearthstone when it's 15 minutes per round, you know, for the speed of light to transmit. But I think I'll be able to occupy my time.
Well, and he wasn't talking about going to Mars. He was just talking about, like, just going to the International Space Station, you know, and she's like having just seen, you know, the Martian or whatever is, you know. Musk's brain was on the first question asked to him and giving her credible responses to that. It's worth checking out the interview. So,
well, that's awesome. Man, I guess I don't want to make it yet another all about Elon Musk. But of course, the other news is that he just sunk a big chunk of his own cash to buy back Tesla stock. Everything's coming up, Musk.
Yeah.
So what was that story that he's just investing more or wants more control in the company himself? Or?
Yeah, well, here's what he says. Tesla Model 3 is Elon Musk's next huge bet with $5.5 billion more of his own cash. However, the Computer World article later goes on to say all $53.5 million of it, which I guess he's putting his cash where his mouth is, all $53.5 million of it and holding on to the stock. So he wants to own 21% of the company, but that doesn't look like the right valuation to me. I know he took a big chunk of his money to buy back a bunch of stock because he's extremely bullish on Tesla's future.
Well gentlemen, that. I'm going to change the topic then.
One last Mustang. I think what's interesting thing about his timeline with the Mars thing is also just the kind of he's hit other milestones before. So granted, these are milestones that are momentous and amazing and crazy, but at the same time, you know, he's got a history of delivering on time, which is what's so special and amazing about this timeline.
Yeah, and it looks like looking at several other headlines, it looked like the final number was $100 million he bought of his own stock. $100 million more.
Always bet on Musk. But all of this is silly, guys. It's futile. It is pointless because, as any reasonable person knows, the Earth is flat.
Oh, here we go.
Oh, that's right. Now, that all dropped since last week. I can't.
No, Brian. This started. I have a mutual friend of ours who manages a very important show in Las Vegas has been texting me for over a month saying, I've got a friend that thinks the world is flat, you know, an intelligent friend who thinks the world is flat, you know, and what do I say? I'm like, well, in my experience, in people who are convinced that the world is flat, there are two things. One is they're extremely not resistant to challenging their own theories. There's no point to discussing them because you will point out, you'll take apart one argument and they'll move on to the next one, not acknowledging that they had their worldview was very based on it, false information before, and they're gullible towards these things. And two, high incidence of schizophrenia. Really, really, really high. Paranoid schizophrenics love the idea that the world is flat because it means that you can have this very big, huge conspiracy you can tie into everything. And I said, I tend to back off from these discussions because when I get into the first, you know, when they throw me their first, you know, what about this? And you debunk it and they don't even acknowledge that it's been debunked or whatever. And they're like, and then what about this? And what you're like, well, that's not a rational discussion. That being said, gentlemen, prove to me the Earth isn't flat.
I mean, that's the problem, right, is you get the music of the spheres. You get the fact that you can create some kind of kludgy workable model, and as long as you're stuck here on the ground, everything might be crazy. You know, it's like you could even tell a story where it's like, well, yeah, when you go far enough from the flat Earth, the air creates a distortion effect that makes it wrap around. You know, when you look at a drop of rain falling down, are you telling me that the world behind it is suddenly a sphere? Because it looks like a sphere on that little drop.
So, best evidence. Why is the Earth flat or round, Brian?
Well, it's the best evidence is because, number one, for me, I was thinking about this when I was looking at some of the proposed, you know, flat Earth things. The nice thing about a round Earth is that gravity makes sense. You have a giant mass that attracts things into it, which is why we can walk around this globe. Absent that globe, I don't understand why gravity would mean anything. Why would things fall down on a flat Earth? You know, if we're on a plane, what causes things to go down? I don't understand that. And then what would cause it to stop going down once you got out of the gravity well? That seems insane. That's my biggest thing. That and the fact that that on a calm enough lake, you don't need, you know, you hear about, like, you watch ships go out in the ocean and they look like they're sinking. On a calm enough lake, you could get your eyes down, you know, an inch or so above that water, and you can no longer see rocks that are on the other side of that lake. And it's amazing. You can physically see the curvature of the Earth. That's why.
That might have to do with the temperature and variance, though, Brian.
Okay. I mean, again, yeah. You asked me for my best reasons. What are yours, Justin?
Like, you've seen these pictures of the Earth?
I mean, you got these here pictures of that round-ass Earth.
Okay. So where did these pictures – did you take these pictures, Justin?
Okay. So, I mean, obviously – There's really, I mean, like, there's no argument you can make that can't be trumped with conspiracy, right? Where'd you get the pictures? Hey, Brian, where'd you learn about these physics and gravity wells from
government run schools?
And Justin, that's absolutely a very valid point. It's a very valid point that if you're going to discount all arguments from authority, and as skeptics, it's important that we understand that it's not about certainty, it's about probability. You know, I'm 99.9% sure this is true. There's other that this person has credible things, but I don't. When we start talking about absolutes, when we start saying things like the debate's over and all that, that's dogma. That's not science. So we have to be careful of that. So, but I would ask for you, Justin, what personal experience?
Well, I mean, personally, I've certainly experienced the differences of, like, sun rising and setting and relative time and the fact that time zones exist so we can keep ourselves on a generally similar daytime pattern with similar sunlight structures. To me, you know, fits with the idea that we have a round Earth that is turning and shining toward the sun.
I mean, I guess really the short answer, and it's the problematic answer, is truthfully, we know this because this is what we were taught and this is what we were fed. And in an alternate reality, with if the three of us were fed a steady diet of nothing but here's why the earth is flat and here's all the proofs there is, you know, here's the optical illusion. Look at train tracks. Looks like they're converging on a point, but they're not really. They stay parallel to each other. That's why it looking like the curvature of the earth, that is also an optical illusion.
I would argue that it's important for us to understand and to get into the habit of sometimes trying to seek out personal experience and understanding, and not so that we'll trump this, but to sort of say, okay, ask questions. If you asked me, like, okay, how would I test it personally? And part of the problem too, and this debate came up, like one of the blogs, I don't know if it was Verge or IO9, and like, if you want further proof that the Earth is round, here's a camera on a balloon, and look, now you can see from up here the curvature. Nope, that's called a wide-angle lens, and whenever the horizon went above the midline of it, it went convex. And so that's the problem, is that we get this, well, obviously this is stupid, and I know this because people don't, you know, they didn't have a basic understanding of what they're seeing, and they said, this refutes, like, no, that's not a really good refutation, and somebody who is a flat earther will point that out, and you will look like a fool.
Right, well, and plus also a lot of the, you know, I think many people have a misunderstanding of how far up the International Space Station is because all the popular flyover photos that we see tend to be a wide angle lens that creates a false effect of the curvature of the Earth being bigger than it actually is at that height. Because ISS is what, I think, five times higher than a commercial jet airliner?
It's 220 miles up.
Maybe 10 or 20 times. Yeah. But still, in terms of, like, you can still see man-made objects and all that stuff. Yeah,
the Earth is huge. It just dominates it. They're looking down at clouds with the feeling of the
I think
right
the metaphor that James Cameron said is we're seeing the curvature of the Earth as if we have our face planted to the side of a basketball. Like, that's how, quote-unquote, far up we are.
Now, for me, personal experiences that made me very aware of this, one is I look up at the moon and I see that there's this round object up there, and I'm like, okay, round, the sun is round, and we rotate around the sun and it stays round. So it seems like, you know, things, the other objects I've observed are round. Second thing for me is on out being out there on a very, very dark night away from the city lights and being able to see the Milky Way and then watching satellites fly overhead, watching those fly over and over again. It's very, I can understand the physics of that falling around a sphere. I can understand or comprehend the physics of that falling around a flat plane. It just without magical things. One is very basic physics, the other one, and then miracle or magic occurs here. And so that to me is like, okay, the hypothesis that needs to be tested then is why, what is the evidence that it is flat? Not how would you prove that it's round, because we have enough evidence to say, no, this is consistent. Where is it inconsistent with it being round? And it's not. There's not any, you know, so that's where my personal experiences come in, is just observation of things that orbit and fly around and going, well, unless, you know, there's a magical property, then it doesn't make sense. But for all of us, we need to have that threshold. You know, what would convince me otherwise? I mean, you know, could I be convinced that I'm, you know, in the Matrix? Absolutely. I think we all could. You know, we're all of us on this podcast agree that we accept this reality because the probability is so highly likely that this is the case. And we can mathematically entertain the idea that this could be, you know, we could go with the idea of, you know, infinite realities, then this is infinitely likely that it's going to be an artificial reality. But I don't have any empirical evidence to guess that on, and it doesn't affect how I behave.
So, of course, this is all brought up. We are talking about Flat Earth, which I didn't know that your friend who you alluded to was friends with Atlanta rapper B.O.B., who made huge waves this week by going on a Twitter spree, not only talking about how the Earth was flat, but also bringing back up to light a host of conspiracy theories that he has. Most entertainingly to me is the conspiracy theory of clone centers. That the modern aristocrats, the celebrity class, are really populated by clones, and that whenever you see one of them in a car crash or having plastic surgery, that this is because they have popped a new clone out to keep us docile.
God knows we're very docile. Boy, I open up the news and look at how docile we are.
Yeah, that's the challenge. It becomes this theory that you can present empirical, rational evidence, but it does not matter because it's when you say I accept the conspiracy as a fact, then there's no point to the discussion because you're not in a point where, all right, give me your best case and then let me evaluate this and give you an answer because it won't matter. But then there's this. And it's like, all right, how do you test your own hypothesis? I had this conversation again with my friend. You know, he's talking about his buddy. I said, step number one is you have to ask yourself, how could I be proven false? How could I find out that this is not true? You know, how would I test my hypothesis?
This is Karl Popper's core idea, which is that the strength of a thesis is not based on the evidence for it. It's the falsifiability for it. Like, all you need to do to disprove gravity is let go of a coffee cup and have it go up once. And then you got some real bad explaining to do.
Mm-hmm. There are theoretical physical models, things like that, that fall outside of there, which is fine. But in the world that we inhabit and we're functioning and have an effect in, it's extremely powerful. And you ask somebody, you know, what would convince you otherwise? If somebody says nothing would convince me otherwise, then okay, we're not having a rational empirical discussion. We're having a religious discussion, and that's outside the domain.
It's fascinating because, as you know, a lot of people like the Scam School program, but there's a few people who feel like talking about any kind of magic trick in a public or an easily accessible environment is doing harm to magic. And it was really interesting because there's a dialogue I was having with someone, and then at some point he's like, yeah, but the problem is like 90% of the people who watch your show don't actually try the tricks or whatever. And all of a sudden I realized the debate was truly over because as soon as either one of us start making up numbers, there's not a discussion to be had. And likewise, there's nothing I can say, well, I'm making up a number that says 100% of them do it. You know, yes. you can't go anywhere with that.
I was at a party a couple nights ago and some subject of like diet soda came up. I had a Diet Coke and this woman's like, oh, diet drinks. I'm like, well, you know, statistically speaking, you know, artificial sweeteners are probably safer for you than sugar. And they haven't found any instances where it's any more carcinogenic than just about any average food you consume. She's like, oh, no, that's not true. I'm like, I can show you sources. She's like, I have sources too. I'm like,
oh my
right.
God. I okay. Yeah. How do you deal with that socially? Because there's a friend of mine who I like a lot. And I'm just doing my best to dodge the issue every time he says something about like, oh, those chemicals. I don't do anything with chemicals in it. And I'm just like, and he looks at my Diet Mountain Dew and says, oh, aspartame, it's going to get you. And I'm like, what is it going to do? And I'm trying, you know, mainly because I want to understand where he's coming from. And I get a story about like, you know, I talked to a neurologist and he said, you on his brain scan, you could watch your brain get clogged up with that stuff. And I was like, I don't know what any of that means. And I can't, I'm like, it's so fascinating because a statistical argument will always lose to a powerful story when it comes to, yeah. to the gut or the heart, you know, it's like, you have to appeal. You have to, I don't know. It's very challenging.
I've had this discussion with people like, well, what if you saw a UFO or what if you, I said, I would assume that I'm just as susceptible as anybody else. You know, that's not the game changer for me. Because I assume that other people have had these experiences, whatever, are intelligent, very good observers. But, you know, for their logical process is then to make their personal experience superior because they've discounted every other human being's process until their own. I don't feel that way. I mean, I'd be like, yeah, I'd probably pay a lot more attention to other arguments, but it's not going to make me, you know, go, guys, I'm listening. It's all over because that's arrogance.
Well, and
I have enough of that already.
That's why one of the most enlightening things of my entire life was to discover how inherently and universally unreliable our own memories were. Like that mm-hmm. just changed my life. And if you haven't seen the light, read up on it as fast as you can. Once you understand that your memories are delightful, but they're also certainly corrupt. We're all broken wetware, and you know, with that in mind. It's like you just said, Andrew, you know, your friends are going to do a better job of creating a simulation that's more accurate to you than you will. Your friends perceive you as an outsider in ways that you cannot. And so I'm the last person I trust on this stuff.
Yeah, well, you're the last person we trust, too.
We'll see. We can agree. Yeah.
No, it's that we have that fear of admitting that we don't know or we don't know this. And that gets to – and the more we sort of – we revere science and knowledge and technology and things like that, often we become, and that's the thing that's frustrating to us, I think all of us here, is that we see this sort of tribalism that arounds this, particularly around certain figures in science and stuff, and, you know, this reverence for them because, well, this person says these wise things and, you know, they must be wise and whatever they say, I'm going to agree with. Like, well, don't be afraid. It's not, you don't, the opposite of saying something's true is saying that it's not, but doesn't mean you have to go to the opposite. You can say, I don't know. I want more information. I'm not quite sure. That's a wonderful place to be. It's a wonderful place to be.
All right. So number one, also to follow up on that B.O.B. thing, as much as I disagree with B.O.B. on the idea that the world is flat and that we have a clone centers pumping out versions of celebrities, I do agree, and I think his diss track on Neil deGrasse is fire. It was actually really good as far as diss track goes.
You got a little bit garbled there. For those who don't know, B.O.B. dropped an amazing diss track against Neil deGrasse Tyson, and it's actually really good. It didn't go convincing me that that the Earth was flat or nothing, but no. it was pretty sweet.
But it was good. I mean, is there a conspiracy theory? Like rank conspiracy theories in terms of, like, if you hear somebody say it, whether or not it affects your friendship with them. Because some of them, like JFK assassinations, there's fairly, you know, you could have a good friend that really has his questions about the JFK assassination, and it's not really going to affect your friendship. But if your friend believes that the Holocaust never happened, that might be a different story, right? Like, where does flat Earth land on that scale?
I mean, I think it's the same thing with somebody who has intolerant religious views, somebody who is a little bit racist or maybe a lot bit racist. You know, you got family that say things and you do your best to avoid that subject or whatever. But think about also, there are friends, people who I love deeply, who could not be more opposite than me on political issues, but because they are patient and understanding and there's a mutual desire to understand the other one's position, we're able to have those discussions. So I guess really, whether it's a JFK conspiracy theory nut or person, let's not use that harmful language, then, you know, as long as there's somebody who listens, I think you're going to be okay with them. But otherwise, I mean, I just dodge a lot of that talk because it makes me really uncomfortable because it's so awkward to – it's such a long process to explain from the beginning. You're like, okay, let's eventually talk about JFK and conspiracies, but first let's start with – standards of evidence. Can we agree? Let's talk about double-blind peer-reviewed studies. Let's talk about, you know, you have to give kind of a primer on the scientific method. You have to sell them on the scientific method first before you can even get into a discussion of the evidence.
Most of my friends are the people I spend the most time with and I get along the most with are the camp of, I think this is likely to be true, but I could be convinced otherwise, and embrace and enjoy that process of, oh my God, you know, this thing that I thought was true, turns out here's this other thing, who love that reversal, love that little, that discovery. They enjoy it. They don't make it, they don't shrink away from it. I have one friend who's a good guy who's kind of a UFO kind of nut, not that he's necessarily. And he's a guy that's just always looking for supporting evidence of UFOs and won't debunk the things that he holds up. And it's like, all right, you know, you brought up these things and then you're how – and he's skeptical of a lot of this stuff. But then he's, well, I don't know, looking at this footage in, you know, raw image format and I saw some interesting stuff. I'm like, did you compare it to others? Did you try to test that? Or are you looking for things to conform to what you want to believe? And, well, no, because it's just – he does. It's probably not even in his wheelhouse to even understand what that means.
But also, I mean, I don't want to take it away from them. It's really, really fun to tell yourself a very specific ghost story that matches key facts and then experience something that matches them. For example, this is a case where, you know, the great thing about conspiracy theories or ghost stories or any of that stuff is that you start with the pieces there and then you weave a tale to where each of these coincidental pieces becomes integral or the result or the proof of the thing. For example, there's this one pair of railroad tracks outside of San Antonio that you park at the such and such time. And there's a ghost story about children who have been run over by a train in the dead of the night at 12:05 a.m. And if you park there 12:05 a.m. and put it in neutral, you'll actually feel the car start to slip forward, right? And then you're like, oh, I know, you're saying it might be on a slight grade or it might just roll on its own or maybe the wind pushed it or whatever. But when you get out and you look at the back of your car, all along the trunk will be the fingerprints of the children. And of course, what happens is every time you close the trunk, you slip a little grease or you wipe off a little bit of dust. But when you get that story and you do it, I mean, it's fun. It's really fun to freak yourself out like that.
I was at dinner party in LA, and somebody I really respect and really, really admire made some comment about that he keeps asking his daughter, who's like, you know, three or four or whatever, every 6 months, who were you before?
The kid stories, the one that gave me goosebumps.
Go ahead. And he says, so far she hasn't said, and I'm biting my tongue because I'm in LA. But I want to say, like, eventually she will give you an answer. It will not necessarily be truthful, but if you want to know how to cause somebody to confabulate, or that's exactly how you get somebody to create a false memory, is you keep asking them that question until they give you an answer, and then you double down on the answer. And so I was mildly appalled, but I didn't say anything.
So this wasn't like a mild social experiment they were doing just for grins. They actually believed in past life regression.
So who were you?
Oh, that's terrible.
Not were you. They were going, who were you?
That's awful. That bums me out.
Yeah.
Because I definitely, one of my earliest memories is certainly, confabulated. It's a memory that didn't happen to me. If I was going to guess, there was one picture up on the wall that is like of a sunset over a wheat field. I think it was a photograph of it or something. But it really was one of those pictures that to a three-year-old could really kind of take you to another place. And in this case, I imagined being like the memory as I play back in my mind is that I'm out in a field. I'm being called in for dinner. And I turn. And the next thing I know, I'm outside the frame of that. And if I was the kind of person that believed in, reincarnation or whatever, that would be pretty compelling evidence in my memories that I went from one phase to another.
Let me ask you guys this, because Gawker had an interesting post that I wanted to bring to you guys if we're on this subject. What would be the conspiracy theory that you hold? Is there anything for which you don't necessarily have evidence, but either through you finding it fascinating or personal bias or any other reason that you would say, yeah, you want to know what, for one reason or another, I am attracted to this conspiracy theory?
That's a tougher one. I am very attracted to the possibility that the entire universe or my experience in the universe is a simulation. The fact that I can quote unquote time travel 10 seconds at a time, where it's like, I'm going to time travel right now. I'm going to show up 10 seconds in the future, but with the memories of the last 10 seconds fully intact. And, I realized, like, when I was in sixth grade and I realized this, I was like, all right, I'm going to do it. I'm going to time travel to 80, and then my whole life's going to be behind me. And as I get older and older and older, I'm like, it's going to happen. I'm going to hit 80, and I'm going to be like, I've done it. For some reason, that's really sticky in my mind, and I'd love to, read more theories about that.
Are there people that are among us that know about this, or are we all just ants in the ant farm?
That's a good question. I think we might all just be algorithms. Just algorithms playing out inside some giant server under a set of rules.
Wait, so the question is, are some people inside the server aware of our active experimenters conscious, like people you might be?
Yeah.
No, that is false.
That
is false.
Take it for he knows. And also, I'd appreciate it if you stop this line of questioning.
Yes, let's move on to another topic. This is...
What about you? Is there a conspiracy theory that's attractive to you?
That the Chicago mob got Kennedy elected.
That they got him elected
in 1960 by way of massive voter fraud. And that's a popular political theory. It would have been a massive issue in its time if it had been in the information age.
but it,
oh, they got to him.
Lost him there. Yeah, this is how it works.
Well, yeah, there's no hard evidence.
There's no hard evidence. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but it is curious because you have, like, you know, in the stories of political machines, you have somebody like, you know, Tip O'Neill, who was Speaker of the House, joking about in the olden days about how they would, you know, flip the elections or they'd, you know, miscount or whatever like that. And so there's a lot of reasons to think, like, yeah, this happened. Did it happen in that case? I don't know, but it's not a crazy conspiracy. And not a thing that only one side does either. Let's make that very, very clear. You know, we don't want to, oh yeah, when they did that, you know, or, but.
Well, and then, meanwhile, there's also, you know, history will not look kindly upon the current day practice of gerrymandering. You know, it's like there's a ways to go before we get the transparency that we want.
But also the thing that makes that conspiracy theory sexy is that, like, it ties Frank Sinatra into it because he would be the connection between Kennedy and Momo Giancana in Chicago. Like, there's a lot that, you know, kind of has the fingerprints of it being inflated, but it's the one I love the most.
Yeah. I sent an article to Justin about, you know, talking about gerrymandering, and it was very interesting because the reporter manages to talk about how it's just a bad practice, blah, 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 but then says, yeah, but when it helps this group, you know, then it's okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, wait a second. You know, it's either say I'm for this or I'm against it. Not when it appeals to my certain, you know, it's like, the great economist said about, you know, says every head of a company I know is a free market capitalist unless it applies to their own business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Milton Friedman. Sorry.
Hey, man, should we segue into picks?
Yeah, let's go to picks.
I already got mine, and I mentioned it. The two books you should read are Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, and What Do You Care What Other People Think? Autobiographies by Richard Feynman. You can also get on Audible, I believe. There's a number of his speeches where he does some fascinating thought experiments. And this is the kind of guy who would just have these incredible ideas and just throw them out with the hopes that somebody would do something with it. For example, he was theorizing, what is the maximum amount of information density you could possibly have. And he didn't think of it in terms of binary coding or of encryption or of compression or of magnetic storage. He thought in terms of, let's make a ridiculously tiny copy of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And he's like, well, how many atoms raised or lowered, how many atoms would it take to make the letter E? And it's like, okay, we can make a matrix. So you see, you get like, we'll say 5 by 8 atoms large, and we could draw the letter E and have a space in between. And then, and he ends up coming up with this theoretical proof of just how dense information could possibly be. And his background, his story, he worked on the Manhattan Project. He was the person who cracked, or at least, you know, made public the reason that the frozen O-ring destroyed the Challenger. I just had an anniversary on that, by the way. Fascinating character. You should definitely read all of his stuff.
Big fan. And there was, I think James Gleick did a book on him called Genius, I think it was. That was another overview of his history. I have a pick for you, and it is Further Adventures in the Wormhole, created by the War of the Worlds epic opera, or epic prog
yes!
rock. It starts off with Brian points out to me, hey, yeah, there's a really cool song at the end of one of the episodes of season 2 of Fargo, and it's the Jeff Wayne, you know, War of the Worlds rock opera. And so then I listen to that song, I'm like, it's cool. And so I get the whole album and listen to the album, and that got me in this thing, like, you know, War of the Worlds, like, I don't remember reading that book except when I was probably a kid, and, you know, the truncated version of that. So I've been listening to that on Audible and then kind of getting into sort of War of the Worlds sort of lore and what it influenced. And then I vaguely remembered a TV show, having seen little bits of episodes or something to that effect. And then I also remembered that in Boy's Life, they used to have the comic strip for the Triads, right? Triads were the tripods. Excuse me, Triads something totally different.
That I was about to say,
the tripods. Tripods was this book, this three volume, actually later more volumes of the book series by. We'll pull up the name of the author, and it was kind of loosely based on a War of the Worlds sort of scenario, but like after they took over, and it's not really a true sequel to it because it's different. But anyhow. John Christopher had a tripod series of novels, and what it took place was like 100 years into the future, and these giant tripods are controlling life on Earth, and people live basically in this sort of pastoral, farm-like agrarian communities. Some of them are kind of medieval, what have you. And it got adapted into a TV series produced in the 1980s, a BBC series, I believe, called The Tripods, and they did two seasons of it. And what happens is when you turn 16, the tripods go and put this skull cap on your head that controls you and makes you more docile. And this one kid's like, I don't want one of those. So he goes off on the run and teams up with some other people and finds out that there's a resistance. And he goes and becomes part of this resistance. And then eventually they find out that there's the city where the aliens live and that they want him to go into the city to learn on what their secrets are and to help them spy. So he goes there, and the season two takes place in the City of Gold, I think it's called. So it's a very I dug it. I found all the episodes on YouTube of the two seasons. It sort of ends on a cliffhanger in the second season, warning. But it was a pretty well-written, pretty enjoyable thing. So it's called The Tripods.
Right on.
And it's like, you know, it's post-apocalyptic after aliens took over kind of scenario. And it could be a very interesting, you know, reboot.
What about awesome. You, Justin?
The Party Decides by Marty Cohen. I haven't read it yet, but I've read a lot about it, so I got it. It's not. I think it's on Audible, but it's like $16 on Audible, and it's like $14 for the physical copy. But it's all about the primary process, and has been written and talked about a lot this term. It was written in 2008, but been written a lot now because we've had such a crazy primary process and. Kind of what goes into voters' mindsets and how voting blocks behave during this amazing element of our American democracy. So I'm looking forward to digging into it, but a little pre-pick, The Party Decides by Marty Cohen.
Dude, I'm going to do that. How did that land on your radar? Just you hear other people chatting about it?
Yeah, I've been trying to read a lot more of like the stat geek stuff this term. And that's been a huge either for or against talking point is this book, The Party Decides, where people are like, well, this is what this book means. And this is what is happening now versus like, well, no, maybe that book had a skewed sample. So I decided to pick it up for myself and I'm pumped to.
Yeah, wow. It's interesting. It looks like a lot of the book is available for preview through Google Books. I just typed in. The Party Decides, and then there's giant chunks that just say like, yeah, these pages aren't available, but these pages are, and then these aren't. These are, and so on. Very cool.
Excellent. Gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.